Welcome to Start With This, a podcast featuring Night Vale creators Joseph Fink and me, Jeffrey Craner. Each episode, we discuss a topic and then give you two assignments, something to consume and something to create. Start With This, satire.
Art is hard. Starting is hard. If you want to start somewhere, you can start with this. You can start with this.
Satire is a blade. It's sharp and it cuts. But cuts what and for what purpose? So you can use a knife to stab someone. You could use a crafting blade to make something useful and or beautiful. You could use a scalpel for medical discovery. You could use a saw to trim unneeded pieces of lumber. Satire is cutting. It typically hurts those it targets, either slicing them open to reveal their most disgusting parts or wounding and weakening them through verbal strike. But it doesn't always have to hurt. Satire can also deftly carve away the edges of monoliths to reveal the respectful sculpture underneath. Not to be all David Mamet here, but there are many uses for a blade. There are many approaches to satire, from blunt assault to subtle shade, from wry consideration to raw sarcasm. Satire is about who and why. Who is your target and why are you targeting them? Satire is the overlap in the Venn diagram of humor, critique, and mimicry. You don't need to hate your target. You don't always use a blade for murder, but you can in some states. You just have to be critical of your target. I'm Jeffrey Craner, here with Joseph Fink. Hello.
Hello there.
Coming off of a previous discussion we had on absurdity, satire can kind of go hand in hand with absurdity, but satire is something I think when you and I talk about making Night Vale, I know that when asked a question about Night Vale being sort of a satire for America or political climate or whatever, that it generally, with some exceptions of some little one-off jokes here and there, I generally find that with Night Vale in particular, I kind of avoid satire. As much as I enjoy satire as a person, I generally find myself sort of avoiding doing it quite a bit. Do you feel that same way, or do you find yourself regularly kind of working in satire?
I don't think I ever consciously decide to do satire. I don't think of what I do as satire. So in that sense, yeah. I was kind of trying to think about, like, what even is satire? And how do you separate it from, say, absurdism? And I think I was coming to this and see if this feels like the right definition for you. But I feel like satire often has an agenda in that it wants to change something, which means that it's always pointed at a human institution or choice that can be changed. So you might satire politics, or you might satire religion, or you might satire your parents that grounded you. But like, the point is, it's always a human thing that you want changed, and so you're pointing out the absurdity of it. You would never satire, for instance, the concept of dying. You might satire like the death industry, but like where absurdity can talk about things like existentialism or dreams. Satire, you wouldn't satire dreams. That wouldn't make any sense. So a satire always kind of has to have an agenda in mind and be pointed at a human institution.
Yeah, I think that's it, is it has to have that target. Yeah, and it sort of feels like it has to be something that's human-made, right? Like something that you can feel like you can do something about.
Yeah, you might create an absurd piece about dogs, but you wouldn't create satire about dogs because it would imply that dogs are making choices that you want changed, and so you're creating this comedy that they can watch to show that their choices were wrong. Like, it just doesn't work.
I mean, we try to satire our cats, but it never seems to take. I mean, they have very thick skin, no matter what we call them or how much we impersonate them. This is what you're like, Barry. And then I act it out, and Barry just walks away. And I'm like, usually that's very cutting, and people start crying. But yeah, I think you're totally right. I started thinking more about satire recently when a small group of friends and I were like, let's do a book club sort of thing. And we read Voltaire's Candide. And I had never read Candide before. I was vaguely familiar with it. I remember probably I was supposed to read it in college, but I know upon reading it recently, I never did. But it very much fits into the Gulliver's Travels sort of world of satire, and even more modern Confederacy of Dunces. that there's this kind of, you know, world traveling thing where you just get where Candide, the main character, is kind of moving on about the world, and he's the, like in Confederacy of Dunces, the main character is kind of the fool, is kind of the person upon which their terrible philosophy kind of keeps creating a different view of disaster after disaster. And Candide is just like, well, this is what God meant for all of us. This is supposed to happen as the world suffers around him. You know, and so that's sort of an example of Voltaire kind of taking on like Christian optimism, the idea that this is the best of all possible worlds because God said it is so. And so he's taking down and wanting to change this man-made philosophy of what's there. So yeah, I fully agree that yeah, it has to have a target of something that can change. I sort of wrote in my notes, like, is doing a Boston accent a form of satire? What about Weird Al Yankovic songs? Are those just parodies and impersonations? Is there ways that those become satire? Like, how do you elevate it from parody?
Yeah, I mean, I think in both cases, no, they're not really satire. Because I think it comes down to that component I mentioned of having an agenda. Satire implies that you fundamentally want something changed about this institution. Weird Al is creating funny versions of songs, but I don't think he wants those original songs changed or is trying to show how those original songs are wrong. And even though a Boston accent is wrong, most people that are doing parodies of it don't have the agenda to end that terrible institution. And so I don't think they qualify as satire. I think you need both elements of having it pointed at a human institution, but then also having the explicit agenda that there is something wrong with that institution that should be changed, and you're trying to illustrate it with this humor.
Yeah, the Boston accent becomes satirical once you start doing a Kennedy impersonation or something along those lines. Or if you're, you know, whatever, if you're, I guess, who's a famous sports person from Boston? You're the sports guy of the show, Joseph.
That's fair. Cheers, is that?
Uh-huh, Cheers.
Ted Danson.
Do you consider satire, like, in general, just to be heavy-handed? Like, do you, like, if somebody tells you something as a satire, do you already expect a heavy-handedness from it?
I think it can be heavy-handed. But I also think, like most things in art, there's rules that are there to guide people who maybe don't have the background to know quite what they're doing. And so you might be like, satire's a little heavy-handed, be careful with that. But the truth is, like most things, if you do it well, it works. Even if it is heavy-handed, I'm thinking of They Live by John Carpenter, which you could not make any argument that it is not heavy-handed. It is a deeply heavy-handed satire of Reagan-era capitalism and the effect it had on regular working people. But it's also a masterpiece because he does the heavy-handed satire well. I would say satire often has a higher degree of difficulty than some other forms of humor. Doing it in a way that doesn't feel clumsy or obvious is very difficult. And so it's maybe not where I would start if you don't have a background in this. I wouldn't start with satire, but I do think it can be done well.
I think one thing that sort of helps satire is time a little bit, like when you have some distance from it. You know, I can't think of a modern day, like a contemporary, like in my lifetime, a political cartoon I've seen actually in the paper live that I'm like, that's very clever. Good job. I'm sure there have been, but they all feel so heavy-handed because they're so immediate. They're about some immediate current issue happening right now. So it's some well-known politician who's, you know, physical features are so exaggerated. But I can think back to like high school and covering like the Teapot Dome scandal or something, and they would run in our textbook some political cartoon that expressed what was happening. And I remember thinking, oh, this is very clarifying. This is helpful. Thank you for this infographic. But also because I'm not having any immediate feelings about the Teapot Dome scandal when I'm, you know, 15 years old in 1990.
This brings me to the execution of it, I think, because I think of, I don't know how to pronounce his name. I think it's Eli Valley, who is a political cartoonist artist on Twitter. I don't know if he has any platform besides Twitter, but he's a Jewish cartoonist, and he draws these cartoons that are explicitly satire, but they're filled with such anger and they have such a specific Jewish point of view that they work in a way that a lot of political cartoons don't work. I think even if you maybe don't love them for any reason, I think you can see that there is something there, because I think most political cartoons are just not very good at satire, mainly because I think they don't have a point of view. Like, ultimately, they're not making a strong push for anything to be changed. They're just like, this person's a hypocrite, or, you know, taxes do this. It's there's not this strong point of view, whereas Eli comes in with these cartoons that, like them or dislike them, they come in with a moral clarity. They have a furious moral message to them. And that makes the satire work for me, because there's a sense of, this is not a person poking gentle fun at these institutions. This is a person who is filled with rage at the moral failings of these institutions and is trying to express that.
Yeah, there's a very rigid demonstration of the point in a political cartoon. It's a very like clear step-by-step of what's happening. And I think time helps us, you know, maybe find the distance and clarity in those things too. But I think just personal opinion and standpoint, right? Like, maybe a lot of the political cartoons I see are so just kind of what you were saying, like they're right up my alley in terms of belief, but they may be just so clumsy or not with a solution or a clear vantage point. They're more just about, I hate this thing. I'm going to make fun of Trump now. Here's this caricature of like how stupid Trump looks and sounds. And I feel like that doesn't really point me to any direction that is helpful. Or in the case of in the political cartoon realm, there's definitely the element of the person you so much disagree with that it becomes hard to look past that sort of thing as well. Yeah, I just pulled up Eli Valley. I do remember seeing his cartoons before, and he has this one on Meghan McCain demonstrating her like claiming of like Jewish sympathies.
Yeah, that one got him a lot of press attention because she called it anti-Semitic, and it's a Jew drawing a picture of a non-Jew.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's I think where you can see that the satire is working, is that she actually responded to it. It upset her enough. It kind of broke through the bubble of the wealthy privilege enough, because it did have this anger behind it.
To use a thing I do a lot when we talk about writing and art is to bring it back to food. But I think in some ways, if we talk about like heavy-handed satire, the political cartoon being one thing, one example of that, but the heavy-handed satire, I think, can maybe be a little bit like a really rich cake with a thick buttercream frosting. Like, at a certain point, it can become too much. Like, at a certain point, it's just overwhelming, no matter how well you did the frosting and the cake. If it's too syrupy, too sweet, too buttery and sugary, it just becomes hard to eat too much of it. You can't take it all in. But there are examples of very, very, very rich dishes, whether it be a cake or whether it be like chicken marsala or something like that, that, you know, the gravy and mushrooms and everything, and all of the butter and fat used in that. It's at a certain point, you're like, this is super delicious and I can't stop eating it. There's a complexity enough to the flavor that you're not getting just the butter and fat. You're not just getting that one note. There's enough complexity in it to keep you wanting to eat.
Or like a really rich cake. Super heavy-handed satire can sometimes just work in very short doses. Like, maybe with the case of Eli Valley, what makes them work is their single panel cartoons. If they were like half hour TV specials, they might feel very overwhelmingly heavy-handed. But you can really enjoy a single bite of a very rich cake and be like, that was delicious. I wouldn't want to eat an entire piece of this, but I enjoyed that bite.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's exactly it. There's only so much of that that you can take. So yeah, knowing the portions that you can consume, I can't imagine seeing a 30 minute animated show entirely done in Eli Valley style. I think I would. I don't know. Maybe that's how you attain galaxy brain at that point. You just become so filled with information. I was looking up satire because I remember studying it way back when, and I remember there being things like Horatian satire and Juvenalian satire, and there's a few others that I couldn't remember, and rather than write all those down, I was just thinking about there's the approach of the simplicity, the simple satire, which is the impersonation, the meme, the one-note joke sort of thing, or one-note poke with a knife of sorts. It may not always be for straight up humor, but it's a single subject target, oftentimes a person. I think this type of the simple satire, I've seen the phrase a few times where people are like, is satire dead in the Trump era? But I think simple satire stops working as much when you feel like something greater is at stake than just being embarrassed by your leader or being embarrassed by the person you're satirizing. But there's a point where, like, I see the number of like Trump satires and out in the world, and I just get sad every time I see them, because I can't feel how this is getting at any bigger truth other than just the creator's frustration.
Yeah, and I think the danger of that is it just gets into the surface level. Like, if your issue with Trump is how he looks and that he doesn't speak well, you're missing the really monstrous actions, which are the actual meat of it. So it's poking at the part that doesn't really matter that much.
I was thinking about more complex levels of satire when you start getting into questions of philosophy or ethos, whether of a person or whether of a bigger movement. You know, Voltaire's Candide is a really harsh satirical reaction to Christian optimism. But I was also mentioning the other day, I finished a book a couple weeks ago called Dear Committee Members by Julie Schumacher. And this is a book told entirely through memos and letters by a creative writing professor at a small New England college. This professor is kind of a 50-ish, late 40-ish white guy who is really in tune with how good a writer he is, even though he's teaching creative writing at a small liberal arts college. And that, on the surface, is a pretty simple satire to make of the guy who sees himself as a big fish in a small pond. And so over the course of these letters and memos that he writes to the college, either complaining about how the econ offices have much nicer facilities than the creative writing department, all the way to like bickering interoffice politics, and you start getting a sense of his level of sexism and racism in the type of work that he does while pretending to be a much more like open liberal-minded guy. The thing that struck me as so interesting about this book was, as I realized by the end of it, what you have is a book that is not just a satire of this type of person in a liberal arts college. It's a satire of the way the economy has destroyed the millennial. And because throughout it all, the recurrent storyline in the background of everything is, and she plays it for humor, but over time you realize what she's doing, which is essentially every time he writes a letter of recommendation for one of his students, you realize every single one of his students in his creative writing program, all of the jobs they're applying for are basically like part-time at the golf pro shop, part-time job working at an ice cream stand, part-time job working in a gas station, an unpaid internship at a graphic design firm, these sorts of things. And the humor, the direct humor of the book is the fact that this guy can't write a simple letter of recommendation without commenting on the student's writing ability, even though they're applying at a gas station. But over time, you realize just how out of touch this person from this older generation is from the struggles that his younger students are facing in the world today. I say millennial, but this book came out in like 2017, I think. And so we're talking about 20-year-olds in 2017. So we're probably talking about the generation right after millennials. But it's talking about the job market for the younger generation right now. And that's what the book ultimately feels like it's really hitting at, that the level of satire is many, many, many layers of what's happening there.
And I think you can find that layering. Sometimes you can find that layering in things that seem like simple satire. You know, our discussion of the idea of just imitation or things like that made me think about Gabriel Gundacker. Is that how you say his last name?
I believe so, yeah.
And he had I don't know if you remember, he had these series of vines that were it was just him getting ready to do stuff. And then as he did that, it would suddenly, a Hillary campaign video would burst in which she was saying, I'm getting ready to do something too. I'm getting ready to run for president. And it was just this running joke that he'd be like getting ready in the shower or like getting ready to play a song. And then suddenly I'm getting ready for something too. And on the surface is just sort of making a joke based on that phrasing. But I think it also was sort of what made it more interesting is it was poking fun at it, very gentle fun at a basic problem she had, which was this weird faux populist tone to some of the videos. This whole idea of, I'm getting ready for something too. the satire comes when you pair that with what most people are getting ready to do, which is like they're showering to go to work or whatever. And then you pair that with this idea of I'm getting ready for something too. And so I think you can start with what is ultimately seems like a really simple satire and sort of find a deeper level there.
Yeah. And it becomes much less direct than just making fun of how she talks, right? Of the stiffness of her delivery. And also, I wanted to mention absurdity and satire too. And we do a whole episode on absurdity as well. And I think absurd satire is so much about creating questions of bigger things than just a single person or group, or in more complex satire of like questioning a philosophy or ethos or economic system or what have you. In absurdity, I think we start talking about the sort of like more like it's more of a meta satire of tropes, of archetypes and language in general. Of when you start, think about, there does become like an absurdity of language once you start using, you know, talk about TikTok and things like that, when people start adding gestures that don't match what they're saying. And on some level, that's absurdity. But I think absurdity at its very heart is always satirizing language, or it's always satirizing the preconceived notions of what we have. And when you start pointing that after tropes and archetypes, I think it becomes much more of a political message. So I think the most common form of satire is a type of sarcasm. It's just this strong tonal disagreement over top what is a verbal agreement with the subject. I feel like I see this the most, wherein you are saying something along the lines of, I mean, yeah, I totally believe in supply side economics. That's totally going to work. Yeah. And so you use that type of thing. That's not good satire, but it sort of is this baseline notion of the words agree with the thing you're satirizing, but it is your tone that shows your disagreement in that. I honestly hate sarcasm, even though I think I use it constantly in my humor, but I think it has to do with the tone. I think sarcasm often is, I use it dryly. I will say it in writing. You know, in Night Vale constantly has this sort of dry sense of humor, where I know with Cecil's voice, he's not always going to make the sarcastic tone. And so it doesn't feel sarcastic to me. It just feels like dry humor to say one thing, but really mean another.
Yeah, I think sarcasm can be done very badly. And I think it can be bad in two ways. One is sarcasm can be done in a way that feels mean. If somebody is like, says something, you're like, yeah, that's totally right. That feels mean. Like you're throwing it back at them in this way. That's an attack. Or
great point.
Or it can just be hacky. I think it can have this feeling, a very hack feeling of the obvious joke, because even people who can't write a joke or don't know how to make something funny, they know that if you say the opposite of what you mean, yeah, I totally love olives, people will get that you're joking. And so it becomes this sort of fallback hack humor. But similarly, I do think, as you said, like it overlaps with things that do actually work and are actually interesting. It's just very easy to fall back into either meanness or hackiness or both.
Yeah. There's the common irony, right? Like the way we use irony is often overlaps with sarcasm. I always think of irony in the common sense as being similar to sarcasm, just gentler. But I remember I don't know if I've told the story on this podcast before, but I had a friend of mine at my old job that was obsessed with Mike Judge satire Office Space. And there's a character in it who's the secretary. He's always like, looks like somebody's got a case of the Mondays. Like it's this classic notion of the person in your office who's always obsessing over Friday and Mondays are the worst. It's a very like Garfield comic strip level sense of humor. And I had a coworker at my old job that just thought that was the funniest thing in the world, and she loved the satire of that movie. But she constantly, sort of to ironically make fun of that character, like Mike Judge is doing in that movie, my coworker would always say, looks like somebody's got a case of the Mondays. And the trick with irony sometimes becomes that you embrace it so much, the making fun of something, that you, in fact, become the very thing that you're making fun of. So in her embracing the satire of that type of office person, she became that type of office person by saying the exact same phrase over and over. The irony just became her exact life.
It's a dangerous line. Like in a much more serious example, I think in the early 2000s, kind of the early internet, there was this idea of being sort of ironically racist or ironically hateful. And the whole joke is, of course, I'm not racist. So therefore, it's funny when I pretend to be. But the problem is that ultimately that line doesn't exist. And I think it even led directly to some people just becoming racist. Like you kind of play that role long enough, it stops being a joke for you. And so I do think that is a real danger with irony, is it can be real easy to lose sight of what's supposed to be funny.
And sort of to your earlier point, in some ways, irony, sort of like some of the misguided political cartoons and satire, it becomes so pointed to the thing that you're not. It becomes so pointed to the thing that you don't like. And it becomes about, I don't like this thing, so I'm making fun of it, as opposed to having some actionable idea of what is a better solution. And it's not enough to just hate something. It's another thing to actually know what it is you want to change. It goes back to the very first thing you said, which is it's having a target and to some point to affect change in some way, not just be grumbly about the thing you don't like.
Yeah, there has to be a kind of moral clarity to satire, I think. People sometimes are uncomfortable with words like moral and immoral, but I do think they're words we should become more comfortable with, because I think if you don't become comfortable with them, then the people that get to define them are generally bad people. When, you know, super conservative or white supremacist people get to tell you what's moral and immoral, then you've kind of lost that. But I think satire can very much be a morality thing. I think that's part of what makes Eli Valley's cartoons work, is that they have a clear moral thought behind them, that this thing I'm condemning is a moral issue. And it keeps it from being surface level, and it kind of keeps a sense of direction by saying, this action I'm condemning or pointing out or amplifying to show that it's wrong, this is wrong. And by saying that, I'm indicating that there's a right way to go. Having some sort of moral vision is what makes a satire feel deeper than its surface.
Yeah, having that clarity of your point of view, that clarity of your own moral standing. And I think you're right about the idea of morality, or the term morality. Like, I think it's been hijacked by people that we think of like as like white Christian conservative sort of soapboxing and grandstanding. This idea that, oh, these are the people who control our morals. This means that only a man and a woman can get married, with the strict definition of what even man and woman mean. And white supremacy and anti-Semitism and all of the things that go with that set of beliefs is all couched in this term of the moral majority. But yeah, I think reclaiming morality for yourself is to like what you value morally, and having a clarity of purpose just in your own life, which extends to your writing as well, as to how you want to take your, you know, pick your targets and do anything about that. I have this note in here about, I think punching up and down is really up or down is a really important thing to know of what you're doing. I am a very big believer in always punch up. Sometimes you may not know which direction is up in what you're punching towards. You know, if you're trying to make a statement about feminism, sometimes you might find yourself thinking you're punching up at men, but you might also be punching down at another group. If you're a white person, you might find yourself punching down towards trans people or people of color. And it's a difficult direction to know which way you're going, but I think it's important to analyze whether or not you're punching up or down. I think Eli Valley is punching up when he's going after Meghan McCain, because he's speaking to basically a rich white child of a very popular conservative and pretty terrible political figure who is claiming Judaism as a Christian person, Christian being the dominant culture in America. I think that is very clearly punching upward.
Yeah, I think just in the name, punching up or punching down, I mean, to tell what you're doing, you just have to understand what the up and the down mean. And essentially, it means power. If you're unsure, just always think about like who has more power in this situation. You know, where is that power flow? Who has more of a say? Who feels more comfortable in this world? And you always want to be essentially punching up the chain of power from yourself, not down it.
Yeah. And I think that ultimately is kind of the beauty of something like satire, because I think it can land really powerfully. But I think satire is a very strong tool. It's not always very subtle. and that can be a really great thing. But yeah, when you do land things, you can be very complex with it, but it's hard to be super, super subtle. So yeah, you want to be careful where you land there. I'll go ahead and wrap this up, and we'll get to our assignments here. I just wanted to mention just a couple more things. We don't need a lot of commentary here, but I just wanted to get to the other components of satire. We talked about sarcasm and common irony. There's also Aristotelian irony, which is this is where the audience knows something that the character or the narrator do not. I think this is an important component because this is an even more subtle form of sarcasm where you, the writer, are indicating this is wrong, and I need you to know that too, but I need my characters to exist in a way that they think it's fully right. There's also overstatement and understatement. We talk about this in absurdity, making the large into small, the small into large, Gulliver's Travels, etc. And then finally, there's parable and parody. Parable is one of the more classic forms of satire, of utilizing, you know, Aesop's fables or things like that, the tortoise and the hare, etc., to sort of demonstrate something happening politically or in terms of current cultural events. So let us take a short break, and then we will come back and give you your consume and create assignments.
Hello, Joseph here. I have two books coming out this year. Seriously, May 11th, 2021, the first 10 years, two sides of the same love story. So there is a love story that happened behind the scenes of Welcome to Night Vale between me and Meg Bashwinner, MC and tour manager for the live Night Vale show. In this memoir, we recount the first 10 years of our relationship, year by year, without consulting each other beforehand. It's a funny and romantic story about how differently we experience and remember our lives. Then on July 20th, 2021, The Halloween Moon, my first ever novel for ages 10 and up. Esther Gold loves Halloween, until the year that Halloween night just won't end. Even she doesn't want Halloween to last forever. No matter your age, if you are a fan of what I do, I think you're going to love this book. Get these books wherever you get your books.
And welcome back. We are going to give you your assignments now. Let's start with the thing to consume. I'm going to give you two podcasts to listen to, and they're both a take on the true crime podcast, but in fiction form. One is called A Very Fatal Murder, and the other is called This Sounds Serious. Both of these podcasts are, as I said, a riff on the true crime podcast format. Both are using satire, and both are cutting up the true crime genre, showing you its insides. But one is using an X-Acto knife, sort of trimming the rough corners, gently peeling back the edges, discovering what really makes true crime tick, sort of being careful and introspective with it, but also critical of what true crime is doing. The other of these podcasts is using an axe, hacking away at the thick trunk of the true crime tree. So listen to the first episode of each of these shows and think about what you learn from each's satirical take on the true crime format. What are the creators' critiques about that genre? Are they making fun of just the way a true crime podcast sounds? Are they making fun of just the whole industry of true crime podcasts? Are they making fun of the notion that, or are they picking apart the notion that, that true crime is exploitative? Like, what are they going after? What are their critiques? And is it conceivable that maybe one or both of these is not a satire at all? Are they parody? Where is your line drawn? So those are two podcasts, A Very Fatal Murder and This Sounds Serious.
Okay, for your create assignment, I want you to choose a person who you disagree with. This can be a politician, a celebrity, a podcast host, it could even be a fictional character, but someone whose views you reject. And I think thinking along the lines of what makes a successful satire, I think someone whose views you reject on moral grounds, who you think is in the wrong for some moral reason, and write a 200 to 400-word opinion column in that person's voice, focused, I think, on the thing that you disagree with them about. And from the point of view of the character that you're writing as, this person, it should be an argument for that point of view. But using the tools of satire that we've talked about, understatement and overstatement, irony and absurdity, ultimately, it is your argument for why they are wrong. Remember that the point of view voice that you're writing in completely buys into this idea, but you are actually trying to make the moral argument on why they're wrong. It's a tricky balance, and this might be a little bit of a tricky exercise, but I think really give it a go. Every word should, on the surface, support what you do not support, but in its tone and context, provide a clear argument against it.
All right, guys, I hope you guys enjoy this. Hope y'all have a great time working on these things. And for those of y'all who are part of our membership community, we look forward to reading what you share up on the forum. Thank you so much for your support. And thank you for listening to Start With This. And that's all for this episode, but your assignment is just beginning. Head on over to startwiththispodcast.com to join our membership community. Becoming a member allows you to share your assignments with other listeners, talk about what's sparking your creativity, and find future collaborators. Plus, you'll be able to ask follow-up questions about this and future episodes, and gain exclusive access to episodes where we answer those questions. Membership is just $5. That's like 3 really decent gel tip pens. We can't wait to see what you're working on. Start With This is a production of Night Vale Presents. It's produced by me, Jeffrey Craner, editing by Grant Stewart, mixing by Vincent Cascione, theme song by Joseph Fink. All other music is by Caged Animals. Find more at cagedanimals.net. Check out nightvalepresents.com for more information about this show and all of our other shows. Thank you for listening. All right, Joseph, we always like to close these out with an inspirational quote about writing. You know the famous quote from Chinua Achebe, who once said, "I believe myself that a good writer doesn't really need to be told anything except..."
Oh, sure. Doesn't need to be told anything except, "That's a good hat, Chinua. You're right to buy it and wear it all the time, and we really like that hat."
Totally, totally relatable. Thank y'all for listening.
Alice Isn't Dead is a horror thriller road trip from the team behind Welcome to Night Vale, and starring Jessica Nicole of Fringe and Night Vale. A truck driver searches the country for the long-lost wife she thought was dead, but Alice isn't dead. If you love American Gods or Stephen King or Night Vale, you'll love this show. The entire series available to binge now wherever you listen to podcasts.
From PRX.